This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, To Reach a Reason, Finding Spiritual Fulfillment as a Caregiver, and the author is Desiree Rogers, and Desiree joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Crossbooks. Hello, Desiree.
Hello, Steve. Thank you so much for taking the time for this discussion about my book.
Well, looking forward to it. This is a difficult road. Many people are facing it today because we're talking about the reality of Alzheimer's, and one of our loved ones, in your case, your mom, 10-year journey. You say this is a book that will provoke reflection within you and redefine your perspective regarding the challenge of caring and as a caregiver on a spiritual level, not just, of course, the demands physically and emotionally, but you've taken it to another level spiritually, which I'm sure was it your saving grace to be able to help your mom through 10 years?
I believe sincerely that it was. To Reach a Reason, Finding Spiritual Fulfillment as a Caregiver, for me, was written to provide support for caregivers who think they are on a lonely and isolated journey. I believe they realize that God is their companion once they connect with this book and find comfort during this challenge. And I believe that this book provides a window into what blessings can do in the midst of such a challenge. And at the beginning of this journey, I began to look at perceptions from God's eyes rather than the perceptions and challenges through my own eyes as a caregiver.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that was very important because it's so easy to get weighed down with just all the day-to-day needs of the loved one who's struggling with Alzheimer's disease. It's easy for me to talk about. I can't even imagine, and I think everyone would feel that we, because it's literally comes at you every day, and where you probably easily could get discouraged. But first, before we get into more, Desiree, now professionally, do you have any ties to this kind of caregiving? What stay-at-home mom, professional? What's your background?
Well, I have actually been in the field of aging for about 30 years. And when I was introduced to the area of gerontology, it was fairly new, and not a lot of people saw it as a career path. And once I began to get into my field and meet seniors on all different levels, it gave me a perspective of how one ages, and taking that information and being able to take my own educational knowledge and be able to help seniors on an individual and group level. I've met seniors really in every aspect of life, rich seniors, poor seniors, seniors in nursing homes, seniors that wanted to do volunteer work to help other seniors and their community. So I really, during that course of time, had the opportunity, and for me, was a blessing to be able to meet so many people, seniors, in that capacity. But then I never thought that this experience of having to be a caregiver for a loved one with Alzheimer's would be my course in life. And thinking that all of the seniors that I worked with in their 60s, 70s, 80s, who are vibrant, living their lives and doing so much, I really thought that that was going to be the course for my mom. But it didn't turn out that way. It was not God's will for it to be that way. So I had to accept what journey was given to me to be able to fulfill what I was supposed to do as a sibling to help my mom until her last days.
Right. She passed away 3 years ago, March of 2011. Now, this must have been quite a decision to take care of your mom at home. I mean, were there moments before that where you think, I can't do this, or did you kind of go in it with just so determined? Or I mean, how did that decision come about?
I think that initially I didn't really think of it in the perspective of how I couldn't do it. I always thought that there was always a point to get to from point A to point B, that there's always other avenues to get from point A to point B. And even though I knew that it was going to be a struggle, my family knew it was going to be a struggle, if one way did not work out, we had to figure out another way to get to point B, from point A to point B, in order to accomplish what we needed to do in terms of her care. So if I had to take two steps back for every three steps forward that I had to make, then I, in myself, spiritually, I had to accept that and know that eventually God's will would reveal itself so that I would be able to do what had to be done.
Were there moments during that 10-year journey when you said, I can't do this?
There were. And my siblings and I admitted to ourselves that there were times where we really didn't know how to approach some things, even though we were on the phone and talking to some professionals in some perspectives about some issues. We did. We really did have a feeling that is there really an answer to caregiving? And the answer would not always reveal itself, but we had to know that the answer was going to be there somehow, some way, on a spiritual level, that it was going to be revealed to us. So, and that was the confidence and the hope that kept us going. Really kept me going.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Really interesting.
As you look back on this whole area that we broadly label caregiving, and of course approaching it at this spiritual level, has your definition of caregiving changed a lot?
I believe that it has. There's always a textbook way of approaching it, looking in various articles, reading various materials, and getting a sort of how to approach in order to address some things. But then in between the lines, there are some things that you have to really experience and figure out for yourself. And I really believe that had I not looked at it on a spiritual perspective, that I would, for my own goals, I would have fallen short and just felt like I can't do this.
I'm sure it's an understatement to say spiritual fulfillment as a caregiver is a process. I mean, that I think it's pretty evident, but it is. You have to, like you've already talked about, it's day to day, and you've got to keep yourself up at that level.
Yes. And the only way that one, I believe, can do that is you have to realize that there's a process of submission. Then in that process of submission, you have to go to God and say, I'm not going to have the wisdom to approach this. I'm not always going to have the strength to approach this. I'm not always going to have the hope to approach this. But looking at it in the perspective of total submission to God's path, his journey that he wanted me to fulfill, that was when things actually began to reveal themselves. And the three concepts from the book that I look at are actually wisdom, strength, and hope. And there were true life instances that I could not even imagine from my own perspective would occur had I not gone down that path of submission. And I actually write about the fact that there was a situation that occurred in terms of wisdom when my family and I did not really feel that some of the medical staff that we relied on to give us some direction and answers were very forthcoming. I actually prayed and asked the Lord, where do you want me to go with this? I'm not sure how I should approach this. And then a little over a month later, I, at my job, spoke with a woman, and she was a call that was just given to me arbitrarily to answer a question in regard to her needs. And then she had talked to me about her own issues regarding memory loss and how she was so concerned about that particular issue for her because her daughter was so dependent on her in caring for her children in terms of babysitting and doing little things to help her. And she ended up finding out about a doctor that was able to assist her in terms of her medication, interventions, encouragement, and support. And from her giving me that information, I in turn was able to connect with that medical intervention and was able to give the kind of support and place for my mom the kinds of things that needed to be put in place so that she could have the kind of care that she needed. And I truly think that that's a blessing from God, because this client could have been given to any other person from my office, but she was directed to me, and in the course of our conversation, she was able to give me some direction, for which it worked out beautifully in terms of how we were able to get the systems and interventions put in place for my mom's care.
Would there be anything that you would change, you know, of how you took care of your mom? What would that be? Was there anything that you would change?
You know, in all honesty, I don't think that I would change anything other than the fact that I would have looked at the concept of forgiveness more in depth than I did. And I touch upon that in the book, and I was able to cross that bridge of forgiveness in some aspects of our relationship that I think became part of the latter part of the journey and not at the beginning. So I think if I had to change anything, I think it would be having more courage to face head on that concept of forgiveness. But I'm glad that it happened the way it did, because even though my mom was not able to verbalize as much as she could have to tell me things about our relationship, for what I was able to get from her, I think that closed the door and cemented our commitment to each other in terms of our love and care for one another.
Your book in the table of contents has the end of the book you title Final Words of Prayer. What is that?
I wanted to leave the reader with a sense of prayer, a sense of hope in terms of the journey that they were going to take or had taken. And with that prayer, I wanted to give them something from my heart so that they could carry it on, for which if they had to in turn give someone else the kind of encouragement that was needed for their particular journey, that it would be something ongoing. It wouldn't be just a story to read and close the book. They would be able to read a prayer that I wrote so that they can continue on and share that, so that the journey could continue on and the positive nature of what that journey was about could go on. And I write it as such. I said, "Dear God, in prayer, I beseech you to hold the caregivers of a loved one with Alzheimer's near, to take away their uncertainty, to take away their fear. Just when they think they cannot carry on, hold them a little closer, God, so they may receive your inner peace and calm. When they cease to understand the direction of your guiding hand, open their hearts to embrace your words and seek your divine plan. Amen."
Well, all I can say is amen as well to that. We've been listening to Desiree Rogers, the author of her book, To Reach a Reason, Finding Spiritual Fulfillment as a Caregiver. Desiree, tell us how to get your book.
The book is available through Cross Book Publishing and also on my website, which one can actually Google my website as www.toreachareason.com. And also through BarnesandNoble.com and Amazon.com.
Well, thank you so much, Desiree, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate your time. And God bless you, and God bless those who are also taking this journey.
Thank you so much. And this interview has been brought to everyone by Crossbooks.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing. And we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Dix of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Why don't you look at the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear these latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Connect with Juliana and connect with what lies beneath. Friday afternoons at 4 or 3 Central on TogiNet.com. Juliana is a marriage, family, and child therapist who wants people to connect. Connect with what lies beneath, those truths and answers. And through her counseling practice, she has helped others find their personal power and fulfill their dreams. And she wants to do the same for you. Here on Connect with Juliana. Through intimate discussions, intriguing subject matters, and the expertise of her guests. For more on the show and Juliana, check out her webpage. Connect with Juliana in media.com. Juliana will cover it all. Nothing is off limits. She wants to know what matters to you. Make the connection. Tune into TogiNet to connect with Juliana to find out the facts that could be hidden beneath the surface. Connect with Juliana on TogiNet to make a quality connection in your life. Friday afternoons at 4, 3 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and for Indie Book Publishing Trafford Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Our book today is titled The Infantry Adventures of Sergeant William G. Altenhofen. Thank you, sir, for joining me today. Bill, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Jay.
This is a curious title in some way, and I'm guessing from this that is filled with your personal reflections and the adventures that you experienced while you were in the military.
I meant it as the way I wrote it, I included a lot of people beside me, and that was actually this was a title that Trafford came up with.
And what is the time frame that this covers as far as your life story?
The time frame would be from 1961 to 1976.
1976. So you were a career military.
Right, yes.
Why did you decide, I want to tell my story?
Well, the motivation was really, after I got into the infantry, I saw how the Army operated. Okay, it was kind of a do as I say, not as I do situation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, basically, I got this idea from just maneuvers. Okay, the Army every year runs their, everybody runs a maneuver, and the way they'd go out would be the unit would go out. And depending on how big it was, they would set up a whole bunch of big tents, large wall tents. And these were all used by the officers for setting up their cots and sleeping and the mess hall and headquarters. Everybody had a big tent. And then the troops would be going out in the field and sleeping in pup tents. And they basically... would go out there and use flashlights and whatever they could carry along with them. But the idea of a maneuver was supposed to be a wartime situation. See? And here these officers are sitting back here in their tents. They would usually take the signal guys about a day to set up all the lights and the generators and everything. So it looked like a mini city out there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it just was kind of ludicrous, you know. They say, okay, you know, the enemy's over there and he can fire artillery at you and all this kind of stuff. So they're telling you, now, be quiet, don't use lights, you know, and things like this. And at the same time, some of these guys are in back of us with all these lights, you know, the tent city back there. So that, you know, but getting them to change this was almost impossible. It was such an ingrained thing in the Army.
Yeah, basic inequity of enlisted guy and military brass.
Right, yes. My idea was to use small unit maneuvers. I wanted to use it a platoon-sized unit where one platoon would go out in the boonies, set up a base camp, and another platoon would go basically somewhere in the same within the same area and set up a base camp. And then they would maneuver against each other. And the idea being you had to impose all the restrictions, light, noise, password and challenge, and all these things to protect yourself. And at the same time, go look for the other guy, see if you could find him, you know, run patrols. And, I mean, this was all what I wanted was basically a small unit. Two platoons being out there to do this. And I figured if I kept it small, it would be easier to put it across.
Right.
The first time I ever proposed it was to a lieutenant, and he was up in Alaska, and he bought the idea, but it went as far as the company commander. And that was to put the kibosh on it. Well, it's some years later, I had an opportunity. That was the first time I tried it. I brought it up was in 1969. But in 1972, I was at Fort Knox, Kentucky, and I was in a committee teaching foreign students. Now, these students, I said in the book, they only understood about 40% of what we said in English.
Hmm.
And I didn't speak Laos or Vietnamese. So I asked them, you know, I asked these students... You know, we were teaching, basically we were putting them through basic training, you know, in the Army style. So when I got into the committee and I asked them, you know, asked the students what they did in the past. I mean, most of these guys were combat veterans. And I found out that some of these guys had been in combat for 10 years, some more, some a little less. I mean, we were not dealing with basic trainees here. We were dealing with veterans, you know,
yes.
Experienced people. The Army, about the same time, came out with a new program for teaching. They wanted to have more hands-on training, less talking. Okay, my first committee was machine gun committee, and the introduction to machine gun took something like a day and a half of what they call platform instruction, where somebody was standing on a platform, showing them the machine gun, telling them all about it, range, the capabilities, the whole bit, and then going through taking it apart, cleaning it, putting it back together, aiming it, so forth. And I'm thinking, you know, if these guys can only understand 40% of what we do, what we talk about, you know, where's all this leading us? So the Army come out with a letter. They said they wanted more hands-on training. So I kind of dumped in my lap, and I had 30 days to come up with a new way of teaching this stuff. I come up with the idea of breaking down the classes. I had five different classes on the machine gun. Everybody taught a different part of it. They taught the, either assembly and disassembly and cleaning, or sighting and aiming using the tripod and T&E mechanisms, traversing and elevating. And another part was range cards, how to make a map of the field in front of you to an estimate range to targets, and what the setting would be on the T&E mechanism so that you could fire at night without actually seeing the target. I had broke all these things down. I had six stations, and set it up. So the way I set it up was the first class, everybody would be at a different station. The second class, half the stations would be on the other half. Three of the stations would move to three of the other stations, so that I had a double group on each station. Then the group that just had the class would help teach the next group the same class I just gave. So I'm repeating the classes, and this, I had a rotation set up. So it took a day to get through, and then the second day we practiced sighting and aiming, using a target at what they call the 1,000-inch range. And this was practice in using the traversing and elevating mechanism, which nobody in the Army ever understood. So the third day, we actually went out to the range and fired live fire and had to make up a range card at the same time. After they fired during the daytime, using all the things that I told them, I would pick up all the range cards, send them the supper, and bring them back at night when it started getting dark, and I would shuffle up the range cards and I'd pass them out to the troops and tell them, okay, go to the point that's numbered on the top of the range card, and we're going to fire at night using the information that's on the range card. The first night that we did it, the guys had to, let's say they cheated a little bit. They didn't write down complete information.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't sure what they were doing. And when we started firing, I had bullets flying all over the country.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I was worried about a village that was about 3 miles away.
Oh, my.
Yeah. But anyway, after we got all finished, I went through the whole thing. Every target that we had fired on during the day, I had made them fire it on again that night. After they all finished, I gathered them up and said, now you understand why it's important that you put good information down on these cards. See? So I was fortunate. The next group of students that came in came before these guys left. So they told them all.
They learned.
Yeah. So things went better from then on. But yeah, it was just... And then... I actually got the chance to do it with recoilless weapons. And while I was on a roll, and after I got done with the recoilless weapons, they put me in charge of another section, and that was the maneuver section. That was where they went out in the field and used to run practice ambushes and things like this. And part of the training was just what I call a long walk in the woods. They would just basically walk them out, something like 1,500 meters, and turn around and come back. And that was the end of it. And I said, well, these guys are all combat veterans and all this kind of stuff. Why are we putting them through this? You know. So I talked to my officers in charge of the committee there, and I told them my idea, which was put them out in the field, had them set up a base camp. And we had American aggressors at Fort Knox there. We had one platoon of aggressors that was for the whole school. It was the armor school. So I had them, our addressers would do the same thing. They would go out in the boonies and set up a base camp. And then I explained to them about light and noise discipline, the password and challenge, a whole bit, and actually had them patrol and look for each other. And, you know, my idea was, if they found each other, it was up to the commander of the unit to decide what they wanted to do. Mm. They want to go attack them, you know, leave them alone or whatever, you know. But fortunately, nobody ever found each other.
That's incredible.
Anyway, but that was where the thing started, and it worked out real well.
Were most of those adventures stateside, or did you also experience some things overseas in other environments?
Oh, yeah, and down in Panama. This was before, I mean, before I got that part. When I was down in Panama, my first assignment as an infantryman was at Fort Riley, Kansas, and I wound up as a dispatcher in the motor pool. And, one of the problems, well, that was during the Eisenhower administration. I explained that in the book. During the Eisenhower administration, part of the way that Eisenhower was trying to save money was cut down on how many vehicles they used and how much they used the vehicles, saving gas, you know, stuff like this. So they had this program called administrative storage, where they would basically park the vehicle and not use it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in a battle group, and we had something like about 120 vehicles, which was mostly deuce and a halfs and jeeps, three quarters, some track vehicles. But 80% of them were in administrative storage. Some of them hadn't been used in 4 or 5 years. So when the Cuban crisis came along, the 1st Infantry Division down at Fort Riley was alerted that they might have to move to Cuba. I don't know, in case when Kennedy went toe-to-toe with the Russians.
Right, the Bay of Pigs invasion, was at the same time frame?
Yeah, right, it was the Bay of Pigs, right. So we were alerted we might have to move to Florida. So they got all excited about, we're going to need everything, right? And they found out that all these trucks that were sitting in administrative storage didn't run anymore. The tires were all wore out. I mean, they rotted. Mm. Canvas had rotted. And just a big scramble to get all these vehicles ready to roll. And so all of a sudden they found money to rebuild all these vehicles. New canvas, new tires, and a lot of maintenance work that had to be done. And then the other problem was drivers. They just didn't have enough drivers. So what they were doing up until then was any time a unit wanted somebody to drive, they just send them down and say, this guy needs a driver's license. We'd give him a quick test, check his eyesight and coordination and a few other things, and send him out. Somebody take him out for a ride, let him drive a vehicle around the block, and he had a driver's license. But the motor sergeant's complaint was always, a driver in the Army at that time, a driver of the vehicle was supposed to pull what they called driver maintenance, which is basically you went around the vehicle and checked the tires, make sure it was all no flat tires, no holes, or, you know, nails, stuff like this, make sure all the lights worked and windshield wipers, things like this. And then when you got all that done, checked the oil, then you got in and you started to kind of truck up. Well, nobody ever told these new drivers that's what they had to do.
Hmm.
And Mortar Sergeant was always complaining that the drivers weren't pulling their maintenance. So I suggested that since we had to have all these new drivers anyway, that we could get all the people down there from all the companies at one time, and I would give them all the preliminary tests, all the coordination, eyesight, and everything, and written test, and show them, or teach them how to use all the forms that they needed to drive a truck, including accident reports and whatnot. So the S4 officer was named Major Smeds. He liked the idea. So that's what we did. It took me about 2 weeks to go through all these people. I had about a little over 100 people. And it took me about 2 weeks to go through there and give them all my part of the instruction. Then motorcycle took over and showed him how to do the driver maintenance. And after he got that done, and we had a truck master, and he showed him, took him out, showed him how to drive. Well, basically driving, and then driving with a trailer, and driving in convoys, and then we threw in day and night convoy, driving with minimum lights and so forth. So it took about 6 weeks for the whole program to get it finished.
Of all the things that you were involved in the military, what is the one story that you like to relate that was perhaps the funniest thing you've ever seen?
Well, it'd be the one with the time where the captain was riding on in the jungle, where the captain was riding on the bulletin board, and this idiot forgot the meter to check electricity, continuity on the electricity.
Uh-huh.
And he was talking to himself, and he said he wanted to check to make sure all the explosive charges were set up right. And he said to himself, he said, "Now, if I just touch the wire real quick, throw the switch on and off real quick, maybe the electricity won't go through."
I can see it coming.
Yeah, this guy was about 250, 260, writing on the blackboard.
Oh.
6'3", you know, he was a, I forget it, either a guard or a tackle for LSU in the early 50s when they really had a good football team. But, yeah, hey, he was huge, and he got knocked on his butt.
That's hilarious. Who do you think is going to enjoy reading your book?
I was thinking maybe the older guys. I was thinking, you know, I waited till this long because I wanted most of them to die. But the 60-65 group. Back when we had a draft, that should be about their ages right now.
Yeah. People who can relate to the inadequacies of the military and can relate to some of the stories you're sharing. Was there anything challenging about writing your book, Bill?
Well, spelling was the biggest one. What happened was I would think of something that happened, and I would write it down, and then it would, you know, like a conversation, I would drift off to something else. It would remind me of something else. So I was kind of disjointed on the whole thing. I mean, some of these stories, I mean, really, year to year, I was going from, say, 62, 63, over to 70, and then back and forth. So that was one of the things I had to get all, after I got all the, what I did was just roll up all the stories. And after I got them all done, then I paged through and put them in some order to continuity,
yes,
so to speak.
Well, that's always difficult for an author to get the story straight and make it work. But I think you've done a good job. Got 204 pages. That's a pretty remarkable achievement just in itself. Where can our listeners get copies of your book, The Infantry Adventures of Sergeant William G. Altenhofen?
It would be Trafford Publishing.
All right. And probably if they do a search online for The Infantry Adventures of, they probably would get your name popping up on the screen.
Yes, they would, yes.
Excellent. Bill, we've enjoyed visiting with you today. This is a fascinating account of your time in the military, which includes some human interest stories along with some great humor. So thank you for taking time to visit with us and sharing these, the infantry adventures of Sergeant William G. Altenhofen.
Okay, thank you very much.
For Trafford Press, Indie Book Publishing, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing. And we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres,
Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book title is Connected to Goodness, Manifest Everything You Desire in Business and in Life. It's a tall order, and our author is David Meltzer. David joins us early from California. It's 6 a.m. where he's located. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you so much, Jay.
Tell us about your background. Why are you qualified to give us directions on how to get everything we desire? Because sometimes we have a large laundry list we want to check off.
Sure. I think everyone in the universe is qualified to manifest what they desire in life and in business. My personal experience has been varied, graduating law school and moving into technology and running one of the largest phone manufacturers here in the United States, bringing the first Samsung phone to America, and then evolving into a retirement into my 30s. I went to India and had a transformation and understanding of, instead of going out and utilizing my free will to grab everything that I desired, to actually surrender to the universe, get out of my own way, and attract rapidly and accurately everything that I desired into my life. And that occurred by small things as well as big things. For example, I ended up running the largest sports agency in the world with Lee Steinberg, the Jerry Maguire, and was something as a child that I always dreamed of being a sports agent. I was able to, later on in my life, manifest exactly the life I wanted with family, friends, business, and, of course, unconditional love.
And you've done all this without any hiccups in your career.
Oh, I wish that was true. Actually, I don't wish that was true, because I think some of the most challenging times in my life have been the most rewarding as well as fulfilling and purposeful. So, no, I managed to, like I said, retire in my 30s, and through a variety of circumstances, self-sabotage and other energies that I carried with me and understanding, I managed to almost lose everything, and including claiming bankruptcy and my house and almost my family, which was necessary for me to learn. And as I have currently been reading even Wayne Dyer's book, I can see clearly, that's the way I feel. I can now see clearly what exactly I need to do, and it all came back to me very quickly, fortunately.
And for our listeners who are sports fans, you are also connected with Warren Moon, a well-known entity.
Yes, Jay, absolutely. Warren Moon, not only is my best friend, but my business partner. Warren has had a similar journey in a spiritual sense that I have. We both were partners with Lee Steinberg, and we spun off 4 years ago a marketing company which continues to thrive as we are aligned and share the same perspective of the universe to connect and empower others, to empower others to goodness, and to create effectively collective change and have people feel good and manifest what they desire accurately and rapidly.
In looking through your book, I would describe it as biographical, instructional, and inspirational. You've got three or four different elements in here. Who is going to find this instructional and beneficial to them in their personal growth?
Well, my vision is that anyone who is looking for a straightforward, simple way to utilize principles and philosophies to attract exactly what they desire rapidly would find it useful and purposeful, whether it be students. We have a sports portal for internships.com to manifest at the beginning of your career, to those that are currently in their career looking for significant change and purpose and happiness, and also those that are at the end of their career where they feel that maybe there's no purpose left. And so I think through the entire spectrum of your career, this book is extremely useful to find seven simple principles with their key elements, very straightforward and instructive to allow you to manifest exactly what you desire.
Describe your foundation principle. There are four elements to that.
Yeah, the foundation principle, which is utilized in almost all of the decision-making of your daily lives, is broken down into four values. And those values are your personal values, your health, your family, your love, your experiential values, everything that you've taken from your education, from living day-to-day life, what I call the dummy tax, all that things that we've learned through the challenges that we faced. And then we have our giving values. How does it affect other people, and what energy do we carry and empower to other people? And finally, our receiving values. What is in it for me? How does it affect me? And we create a balance between those four values, which then becomes a foundation for everything that we do. And then just like a house or even a rocket ship, but we don't have a solid foundation, we can't have the confidence to attract what we want rapidly and accurately.
I love the quote that you have given from George Bernard Shaw. If history repeats itself and the unexpected always happens, how incapable must man be of learning from his experience? Great quote. Tell me the process of writing your book. How long did it take? And, you know, what do you feel is the underlying message besides success?
Absolutely. This is the first book of a three-book series for Connected to Goodness, and I use an analogy of building two nightstands so far, because I'm writing my second book as we speak. And the first book is just like building your first nightstand. It takes a long time, and when it comes out, you know, it may not be exactly what you want. And so my first book started years ago as a sales training. And then as I went to India and studied theta healing and energy and others, studied with Lee Brower from The Secret and his Gratitude Rock and a variety of different experiences with some tremendous mentors, it transformed itself into an original book that I had written that wasn't quite there. And then through my experiences, redeveloped a new training in which now I created the seven principles. And it took about a year to write. And so it was a great journey. It helped through my own very cathartic way of understanding myself and empowering myself and now enabling me to empower others.
You've mentioned in personal value, be the first to arrive and the last to revive. What other advice do you give entrepreneurs and individuals who are trying to get ahead?
The advice that I give is to enjoy the effort, not the outcome. One of the most important lessons is to detach yourself from the outcome. And as an entrepreneur myself who has had their successes and has had his failures, that the most important thing is to enjoy the effort instead of focusing on the outcome. Being an entrepreneur is quite simple. All we need to do as an entrepreneur is every day make sure that we're in business tomorrow. And if I do that first every day, and I do wake up very early, so sometimes that occurs before most people even wakes up, but if I can make sure that I'm in business tomorrow, I know that by surrendering and getting out of my own way and trusting the universe, that everything will evolve and come to me in the right way at the perfect time.
What's your personal motivation? Some entrepreneurs, it's money, finances, that kind of success. What is yours particularly?
Feeling good. Connecting to goodness. So all of my desires, free will, etc., is focused in on connecting to goodness, edging, making sure that I don't edge goodness out, which is E-G-O, ego, making sure that I keep my ego, the need to be right, the need to be offended, all of these, the need to be superior, the need for awards or accolades, all these things that used to drive me as a young man to go out and achieve all these things. Now, I have to actually reverse my psychology to keep those into check and to utilize all of this energy that I have to connect to goodness and to be good, feel good, and help others be good and feel good.
In addition to the India trip, how did you come upon the idea of spirituality and how did you incorporate it into your business?
It was a long lesson. So I had, as a younger man, friends who were very spiritual, but my perception of that was, they were at home living on their mom's couch getting high. And then I married a very spiritual woman who I would scoff and laugh and sarcastically look at her visions and her beliefs and thought it was cute. Then going to India and starting to understand and meeting Lee Brower and working with him as they did the movie The Secret, and then through a variety of readings and speeches of Wayne Dyer and other Hay House publishers, Hay House writers, I completely transformed my vision, and I now have found that the spiritual side of me is far greater of a power. It's far more purposeful, meaningful than that corporate dating that existed for the first 15 years of my life.
Well, you've described different life and business stages, and I wondered if you might identify a couple of those for us.
I'm a little confused with part of what you're referring to. I apologize.
Let me ask a question that I'm sure our listeners want to know. Do you feel you've always been successful in following your principles?
Jay, that's a great question. I try to be successful of utilizing my principles as much as I can. One of the caveats, I teach every week, I speak around the world. One of the caveats that I say at the beginning of any of my lectures or teachings or trainings is that I am on this journey with you, that all the things that I have written and that I know to be true or seem to know to be true or perceive to be true, I am still trying to utilize these in my own life. And I thought, you know, whether when I used to utilize them 30% of the time, now I do it 80% of the time, but now that maybe I have a greater enlightenment or understanding, that 80% is now back down to 30, and I feel like I have 70% more to go. So I try my best to utilize these principles. And the key isn't utilizing them all the time. It's how quickly can I shift my energy when I know that I'm not utilizing the principles. So instead of escalating or spiraling, I use an analogy. And this is part of the reason that I wake up early and I try to inspire other people to wake up early, is that my day is like parking a car at the top of the San Francisco hill. And at the beginning of the day, all it takes is one hand to hold this car at the top of the hill. So I have this great reset, this great refreshing. And if I wait until later in the day to try to reset, or I allow even during the day things to spiral, that car starts moving downhill, we all know the probability of me at the end of the day stopping the car with one hand as it's been cruising down the hill all day, compared to being able to hold the car up at the top of the hill. So I utilize the principles and shift my energy as quickly as possible to utilize my principles so that I continually am able to hold the car at the top of the hill with one hand instead of letting it start building momentum, negative energy, ego, and things like that during the day where it's almost an impossibility to stop that car.
It is difficult to be successful when your ego gets in the way, for sure. How would you introduce this book to someone that doesn't know of you or know of your writing?
I would introduce it as a simple, straightforward journey that allows you to utilize seven principles and four key elements to manifest what you want accurately and rapidly, and whether it be in life or in business.
You've managed to pen 216 pages. Was there anything that was complicated or difficult or challenging about writing this book?
The first section was by far the most difficult and challenging part of the book. It's how it all began, and to relive the emotions and to relive the dummy tax and to relive the mistakes was extremely painful, but also valuable and cathartic to me, and it brought great clarity to me. But by far, writing section one was the most challenging thing that I've ever had to do academically.
Well, thank you, David, for sharing your background story on the book, Connected to Goodness, Manifest Everything You Desire in Business and Life. And as I've described it, biographical, instructional, and an inspirational read. The author, David Meltzer. David, where do we get copies of your book?
We can get it anywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, as well as ConnectedToGoodness.com.
And you are in the process of writing a sequel to this.
Yes, I am.
Fabulous. We look forward to talking to you in the future and hope that this is a very successful read for many and they can apply the principles and also be successful in their journey. David, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Jay.
For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.